Back in Daniel chapter 9, I just want to read verse 24 again. I think of all of these prophecies and visions in chapters 7, 8, and 9, a standout passage for me is the 70-week verse 24. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city. And then he lists six things. Finish the transgression, make an end of sin, make atonement for iniquity, bring in everlasting righteousness, seal up vision and prophecy, and anoint the most holy place. One of the observations we made in the class on Wednesday night, and you can see this on your page titled Chapter 9, is that Jesus came and did all those things. We are not waiting for those things to be done. Jesus came and He did them. In Ephesians chapter 2, He finished the transgression of the law. In Hebrews chapter 2, He brought to an end the gravity and the power of sin. In Colossians 1, He made atonement. In 2 Corinthians 5, He established righteousness through His kingdom. In Acts 2, these great visions are fulfilled on Pentecost and the Holy Spirit baptism upon the apostles. And now He has anointed the holiest of holy places, the holy place not made with hands, as Jesus rules in heaven. I've taken great confidence and a great sense of appreciation out of that prophecy in verse 24. You could add that in if you were making a short list of Daniel prophecies all about Jesus. We already know we would have Daniel 2:44, no doubt about it. We've talked about it a lot. We all know we'd have Daniel 7, verses 13 and 14, which adds even more description. And I would suggest to you to make sure you find 9:24 when you're making that list, because it details pieces of the puzzle, different things that He accomplished that the law of Moses could not do, which is kind of the point. All right, let's go ahead and get into our fun and jovial review section. You should be looking at the page of your material that says something to effect of review of events in chapters 1 through 9. I will read and then I will pause at the blanks, and then you just shout it out or whisper it in a way that I can read your lips. Chapter 1, in 605 BC, Daniel is taken into Babylonian captivity. He refused to eat the king's because he made up his mind that he would not do what? He would not defile himself. After being allowed to eat vegetables, after 10 days, he and his friends looked healthier or better than all the others. Bonus question on chapter 1, how old is Daniel when all this takes place? What do you guys think? Collaborate with Miss Jan? Teenager, 15, 16, 18, something like that. I think we miss sometimes the age references throughout this story, that he was just a boy who had been taken from his family, taken from his home, put in a foreign environment, under threat of death at times, and yet he would not defile himself. Did he hold true to that, do you think, for the 70 plus years that God blessed him with after that? He did. Chapter 2, in 604 BC, so very close to that, he's still a very young man. Who had a troubling dream? Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel tells and interprets the dream about a statue of different elements. The dream represents what? Four kingdoms. In the days of the final kingdom, Christ will rise with an indestructible rule. Who can name the four kingdoms bottom to top? Rome. Greece, Medo-Persia. You're not supposed to ask questions that you don't know the answer to. But who can give... No, never mind. I was going to do about the dates. Who can give the dates? It's interesting. Babylon was only about 70 years. And then Medo-Persia about twice that long. And then Greece about that same. And then, of course, Rome lasted a really long time. All right, the most important element of that story is not the four kingdoms. It is in the days of the fourth kingdom. A kingdom would be established that would become this grand mountain. The statue crumbles. the stone, the mustard seed, if you will. The mustard seed grows and has branches in every direction. The stone grows to be an indestructible mountain. It's talking about the church. Chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar proclaimed that all in the kingdom must fall down and worship the, there should be a blank there, the image or statue that he had set up. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not do it and were thrown into the fiery furnace. Because God saved them, Nebuchadnezzar turned to God, a great text, turned to God and put trust in Him. Probably, in my opinion, the strongest words in all of chapter 3 are when he said, I want to report to you what these guys did, how they laid down their life for their faith. God must truly be a great and masterful God. My only follow-up question on chapter 3, real simple question, where was Daniel? Josh.
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, from what I was reading, were the only ones accused. And I don't know if the accusers didn't dare go after Daniel or what, but those were, that's the way it's worded, that they were accused.
Okay, right. Interesting. The text, he's using the text, it talks about accusation. There are several options there. None of them is that Daniel cowered down and worshiped this idol. I mean, that's not in his character anywhere. So he either wasn't in town at the time or he wasn't among those accused. Good point. Chapter 4, after giving praise to God, so Nebuchadnezzar's come through this good cycle. He saw God save these men. After giving praise to God, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream about a what? A tree in a field. Who can tell us very quickly what happened to this tree in the field? Beautiful tree. Chopped down. But then there's, so what do you have left after you chop down a tree? But what was unique about this stump? Had this interesting ring around it, which meant that it mattered in some capacity. Though it had been cut down, it still had some value. And then what happens at the end? Does it actually come back at the end? No, it doesn't. Verse 23, the band of iron and bronze around it in the new grass of the field. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. Let him share with the beasts of the field until seven periods of time pass over him. Okay, so back in our text then, there's a tree in a field. As Daniel tells him, the dream represents his future. He would, what? Live or roam in a field until a period of time has passed. One day while the king was doing what? Say again. Sorry.
Training.
And training? Okay. And training, I can't hear.
Dreaming.
All right. Well, I'm a little bit past the dream now. One day while the king was blank credit for his kingdom, God fulfilled it. What was he doing? He was taking credit. You're right about the dream. He had the dream. After the dream, a period of time passes, and I think it even tells us a little bit about that time. After that period of time passed, he's looking out at his kingdom thinking, look at all that I have done. And then just like that, he's reduced, his hair grows long, his nails grow out, and he roams about in the field. There's some interesting secular collaboration to that. There's nowhere in Babylonian history where it's going to talk about Nebuchadnezzar roaming in a field, but there is at the end of his life, near the end, sort of this period where there's little said about him. It's kind of some interesting facts about they probably just considered him to have some disease or something that was making him crazy. Okay, chapter 5. During Belshazzar's reign, in 539 BC, what appeared at a feast? Okay, this hand, these fingers with his hand appeared at a feast he was having and began to write on the wall, right? It wrote four words on the wall, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parson, okay, or some pronunciation of that. Some Bibles give you little pronunciations for that. Which basically, the handwriting on the wall represented what? The death of King Belshazzar. The death or the end. And this is at the end of Daniel chapter 5, and that same night he died. This is most definitely where we get the term the handwriting on the wall. Whether you recognize it or not, whether you believe it or not, some things are just fact. And the fact is that his ungodliness had led to his end. And we did quite a bit of study on that, about how the Medo-Persians had organized the military effort and executed that effort on that night. All right, so chapters 1 through 5 ends the period of the Babylonians. That's about a 70-year period. And it started in 605, right at the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And you have a couple of dreams in the fiery furnace and so forth. And when you get to the end of chapter 5, you see you've gone from about 605 to 539. You've covered effectively the length of their reign. So when we get to Darius the Mede, we're into that silver, the silver torso at this point, the Medo-Persians. Darius, and I just answered it for you, chapter 6, Darius the Mede took over shortly after when the Medo-Persians defeated the Babylonians. Under his rule, Daniel was what? Very respected, very successful. A great story. Joseph and Daniel's story parallel for me. No matter what's going on around them, they always just seem to kind of float to the top. And they always did so with integrity. They never compromised. They never acted like the people around them. It was the fact that they were different that kept elevating them. And of course, in this story, God did some miraculous things that helped a lot, like giving visions and interpreting them. The other officials became jealous and tried to get him destroyed. They did so by getting Darius to sign an edict that no one could do what? Pray to any other than he for 30 days. Daniel did not relent, but kept right on praying to God three times a day. Daniel was thrown into the lion's den, but God saved him. After he was saved, what happened? The men who had orchestrated his demise ended up dying, they and I believe their families as well. I mean, it was this grand consequence, physical consequence for sin. It reminds me of another Old Testament story. Does it remind you of one? Korah, okay. Korah rebelled, tried to supplant, and then eventually was supplanted. I'm thinking of another. The gallows were already set up. I'm thinking of Mordecai. Remember that story with Esther and Mordecai? And who's the bad guy in that story? Haman. What a story. Why is there not a movie of the week about that every week? This guy is so sure, just like they were so sure, but God. A lot of things, a lot of stories have this turn in the middle called but God. God comes in and his providence and his kindness turn it around. And we see what happens there. All right, he used more providence in Esther's story. Okay, chapter 7. Now, as you already know, and we're not doing our big review sheet today, but things change after chapter 6. What changes drastically in Daniel's letter after chapter 6? Wayne? Okay. It's less story and more prophecy and vision. Okay, that's one point that needs to be made. What else would you say is distinct between chapters 1 through 6 and 7 through 12? Yeah, they fit into chapters 1 through 6. 1 through 6 is effectively the entire 70-year timeline. Chapters 7 through 12 are visions that Daniel received that fit somewhere back into that timeline. We have often in this class compared that to what? Where else do you see that on a grander scale?
Old Testament.
That's the way the Old Testament is written, isn't it? Genesis through about, say, Nehemiah or Esther is history. Covers a long time. But then after that, all your major prophets and your minor prophets and everyone except, we don't know where to put Job. But effectively, all the rest of that stuff, the rest of the Old Testament fits back inside of the history books. Very similar to that. All right. Chapter 7. Back in 553 B.C., when Belshazzar became king, Daniel saw a vision of four beasts coming out of the sea. The four beasts represent what? Four kingdoms to come. Remember, sometimes the language says four kings, but when you dig into the interpretation, most often king is put forth, it's metonymy for kingdom, the four kingdoms. They are Babylon, Persia, what and what? Good, Greece and Rome. The fourth one, Rome, crushed and trampled and would seek to wear down whom? God's people. All right. Until the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man came from heaven, probably signifying the Father and His Son, to set up a kingdom that would what? Never be destroyed. Interesting, the persecution upon God's people, we've seen that in a couple of ways in Daniel's visions. In chapter 8 and chapter 9, we saw it in terms of the Jewish nation in B.C. days. Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, that's not Christians. There was no church. It's just God's people in the 150 B.C. range. Here, perhaps, the persecution that's mentioned is talking about Christians in the first century after Christ had established his church. All right, so that's chapter 7. Not a big deal for us. Two things we were able to do, maybe three, to make chapter 7 work for us. One, he interprets it for us. That's the big bell ringer. He actually tells you it's four kingdoms, tells you exactly what's going on. Secondly, it connects very, very closely to the statue in chapter 2. So it's not exactly confusing for us. The statue had four elements this way. This has four beasts that way. Very similar. A third thing that helped us be a little bit comfortable with the four beasts coming out of the sea is what fact? One, it's interpreted in the text. Two, it's a retelling of chapter 2. But what's another sort of comfort level that we have with the beasts in the sea? It's in Revelation. Revelation 13, Revelation 17. It's a catch-22. You really need to study the book of Daniel before attempting to interpret the book of Revelation. And in some senses, you need to study the book of Revelation before you interpret Daniel. So I don't know where you begin on that, chicken or the egg, but I would recommend this order. Daniel, because why? Chapter 7 and 8 actually tell you what they mean. You don't get a lot of that in Revelation, but here you do. All right, chapter 8, here's a second vision. Back in 550 B.C., during the reign of Belshazzar, Daniel had another vision. And it's really close in time to the previous one. I want you to note that. Only a few years apart. This one was about a ram butting in all directions, which represents whom? Medo-Persia. How do you know it represents Medo-Persia? Going to need your text for that. How do you know that it represents Medo-Persia? Really hard question. The horns are helpful when you look at it and you see there's one long, they're both long horns, but one horn's really long and one horn's not very long, and Persia was the big dog and Medo was the smaller one. It helps, but the best answer is what? My favorite part, he just says it for you. I really wish they were all like that. In chapter 8 and verse 20, the ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. Thank you very much for that. All right. Then comes a goat with a large horn from the west flying across the land to destroy the ram. This goat represents whom? The goat, the whole goat. Greece. We know that because verse 21. It just says it for you. The shaggy goat, Daniel 8:21, represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. After that horn breaks, which we know to be Alexander the Great through secular history and all that, after the horn breaks into four smaller ones, a rather small horn grows exceedingly out of one of them and tramples down the stars of the heavens. This represents the evil king Antiochus Epiphanes from, this is actually a tough question, Syria or Macedonia, any of those regions. The point is Bible land region. That's what I want you to see. Syria is the proper answer. Macedonia perhaps could work as well, although that's a little bit around like this. But he's over in that area. He will persecute the Jews for 2,300 evenings and mornings, probably just a figurative number there, and then the holy place will be cleansed or restored. That is what we saw. What we see in about 160 B.C. is after, of course, Alexander the Great dies young, his kingdom is split into four kingdoms. One of those has this terrible, terrible guy come out of it named Antiochus. He becomes a persecutor of Jews, not Christians, because we're B.C. right here, but the Jewish people. He stops their worship, and it's because that's his region. But after a very short period of time, about 12 years, he gets knocked out, and they're able to restore that. Anybody here ever read the Apocrypha books? Well, that makes none of us. I have it. I keep wanting to get into it. What, anybody remember from our Bible survey what the Apocrypha is? There were about 14 books written. They're written after Malachi. And they're called intertestamental period books. They are not inspired to our knowledge, but they're written by Jewish men in that dark period, which is all about Greece and the splitting into the four kingdoms and the one that would arise. And the Apocrypha gives us some details about the stopping of the worship, but also bringing it back in about 150 B.C. Very interesting stuff. Okay, chapter 9 is what we studied most recently. In 539 B.C., so note, pretty large gap here from the previous two visions, maybe 12 years. The first year of Darius, so we have a new kingdom in place. Following a long and heartfelt what? Prayer from Daniel to God, which is very similar, by the way, to other men's prayers in the Old Testament, like whom? David? Moses, definitely. Moses, because Moses prayed on behalf of his nation who weren't behaving. And the one that I mentioned that I think it's just almost synonymous with is whom?
Nehemiah.
I mean, Nehemiah saw that his nation had misbehaved and it crushed him. I mean, to his spirit, just broke him, and he wanted to make it better. Daniel's very much like that. He's not responsible for a lot of what they've done wrong, but he feels it as if he was right there doing it himself. All right. After this long and heartfelt prayer from Daniel to God, he receives information from Gabriel. Then we learn about 70 weeks or sevens. The first 69 weeks spans from the time of blank to the time of blank. For 69 weeks. Be confident. If you're wrong, we'll all laugh at you and it'll be over. Nobody will do that. Okay, the proclamation to go, rebuild, which is effectively the first year of Cyrus. So it is Daniel's day. If you want an easy answer there, you just put Daniel's time, which is a fair answer. But the actual answer there is from the proclamation to go. So I would say it's right there in 530s when Cyrus said, go home and rebuild. So it starts real time for Daniel. The angel saying, the clock starts today, and the first 69 weeks go up to what or whom? The Messiah. And we have that information. That's not a challenge to us necessarily. It's right there in verse 25 of Daniel 9. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah, the Prince, there will be 69 weeks. At the end of this time, Christ, Jesus, Messiah, will be cut down and have nothing, as is seen on the cross of Calvary. Following this, and I want you to note something here. My interpretation has changed on verse 27. When I originally wrote this material in 2013, I interpreted it this way. Following this, verse 27, in the last week, Christ will do two things. What two things would Christ do after his death? He would make a covenant with the faithful and put a stop to the sacrifices of Israel. So the covenant would be the new law, and stopping the sacrifices of Israel would be what event? The destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. I've since kind of shifted on that. If you have your Bibles open to Daniel 9:27, I would first warn you that capitalization is not what you think it is. This original language had no capital S's for spirit or capital L's for law or capital H's for he. That's all sort of interpretation. But in verse 27, the he's that I have are lowercase. Who has that in verse 27? That means that the translators decided that this is not Jesus, verse 27. This is instead the agency that came in. This would be Rome or Titus, or Nero, or Domitian. This would be the Roman government. And so following this, following Jesus' death, in the last week, the Romans and the Roman ruler would do two things. He'd make this sweet deal with the Jewish nation, and then he'd end up destroying them. It's interesting that it sort of is Christ, even if it isn't, because it was the will of Christ for the Jewish people and Jerusalem to fall because of their sinfulness. But probably now I would change the material you're looking at, and I would say the Roman ruler or the Roman warrior Titus or something like that. And the reason why I think that that's the case is look at the very, very end of the chapter, last line. even until a complete desolation, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. I think it's saying that the Roman ruler will destroy Jerusalem, and then at the end of the 70 weeks, God will destroy the Roman ruler. That wouldn't be Jesus. That would be the Roman ruler. So that's why I've shifted that. All right, that's a bit of a review there. Thanks for moving through that with me. Any comments or questions about this? Yes, Paul?
The abomination of desolation in Daniel 9:27, right after the part you were talking about, where it says, "And on the wings of abominations shall be one who makes desolate." Isn't that what Jesus was talking about in Matthew 24?
It was. It was. And if you interpret the pronouns as Jesus in verse 27, you still have to acknowledge that it changes there. It changes towards this Roman desolator. Yeah. All right. That brings us to chapter 10. Now, the interesting thing about chapter 10 is we get a little bit of a breather. It's not a complicated vision. It's just sort of some really interesting setup for the most complicated vision. So, welcome to Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, chapter 11. I'm not going to make any promises. I know me too well. But I have found a really cool chart that's going to help us with chapter 11 a whole lot. And that's going to be up there, and I'm going to send you all that stuff. Have I told you that yet? That I'm going to send you all that stuff? I hope that the key to help me to remember to do that by Wednesday is I've got to get you that chart for chapter 11. I want you to see it. Even if you disagree with it, at least you can kind of see something from which to compare. So all that's coming on Wednesday, but we get kind of a little bit of a breather here. Look in chapter 10 and also look at the top of your page. The year is 536 B.C. or roughly such. It's the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. So we're at the very end of Daniel's life. At this point, chapters 10, 11, and 12, Daniel is 85, maybe 90 years old. This is probably the last thing he was a part of. This is our last time reference in the book of Daniel as far as when the vision came. Probably indicates that all of what you're about to read to end this class in 10, 11, and 12 were given all at the same time. Just after the 70 weeks vision of chapter 9. There's a vision of warfare, which will be described in the next two chapters, and it affected Daniel very deeply. So let's do just a little bit of reading. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, and the message was true and one of great conflict, but he understood the message and had an understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, identifying himself as the author of this book, had been mourning for three entire weeks. I did not eat any tasty food, nor did meat or wine enter my mouth, nor did I use any ointment at all until the entire 3 weeks were completed. I wonder if that means soap. I don't know. On the 24th day of the first month, while I was by the bank of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a certain man dressed in linen, whose waist was girded with a belt of pure gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl. His face had the appearance of lightning. His eyes were like flaming torches. His arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze. And the sound of his words like the sounds of the tumult. Now I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, while the men who were with me did not see the vision. Nevertheless, a great dread fell on them, and they ran away to hide themselves. Two more verses. So I was left alone, and I saw this great vision, yet no strength was left in me, for my natural color had turned to a deathly pallor, and I retained no strength. But I heard the sound of his words, and as soon as I heard the sound of his words, I fell into a deep sleep on my face, with my face to the ground. Kind of sounds like he just fainted. He hadn't eaten. And he was sort of trying to decide what this meant, and then he fainted. Now, when you read this description, the lightning and the bronze and the brightness, what does it make you think of? Where else do you read about this? We've seen this. I almost said we've seen this before. That's a timey-wimey comment. This came long before that. But we as New Testament students have seen this before. Where? Look at Revelation 1. Interestingly enough, remember, there is so much connection between the descriptions and the visions of Daniel and the descriptions and the visions in the book of Revelation. If I'm looking in, say, Revelation 1:13, I saw one like a son of man, clothed in a robe reaching to the feet and girded across his chest with a golden sash. His head and his hair were white like white wool, like snow. His eyes were like flame of fire, his feet like burnished bronze. And it goes on and it explains this. And I'm convinced absolutely in Revelation 1 that it is depicting Jesus. I think there's no question verses 17 and 18. I don't think you can get around that. He is the first and the last and the living one. And I was dead, and behold, I am alive. I have the keys of death and Hades. So Revelation 1, definitely this astonishing image of Jesus. Now I'll say this, if you go back to chapter 10, I don't know that that's the case in chapter 10. What are some options as to who Daniel is seeing in Daniel chapter 10? Could be Jesus, though there's nothing internal that demands it. Who could this be? He's had a lot of interaction with angels, hasn't he? What are some names? And you remember these from sort of pop culture fiction, though there's nothing fictional about it. We've got Gabriel in here. Before we're done, we're actually going to get a look at Michael, verse 21. Those ring some bells, right? Well, they're probably ringing the wrong bells. They're ringing bells for people today who talk about them. This is the original bell here. This is Daniel saying, I have interaction with these angels. Gabriel spoke to me. Michael's doing some work. And probably chapter 10, verses 6 and 7, probably is describing just heavenly power, you know? If you were going to describe a messenger of heavenly power, you would probably use phrases like, he has the appearance of lightning, his eyes are like flaming torches, his arms and feet like burnished bronze. So you see the shiny, powerful thing. I mean, what else is there more powerful than lightning and fire, right? So probably that's what's going on. And I've noted some of this on your material, verses 4 through 9. A heavenly being appeared to Daniel. The description, very similar to Jesus, however, likely describes the purity and power and heavenly nature of heaven, of the message. But here we're probably talking about Gabriel or Michael or one of those, as we'll see in a minute. All right, look at verse 10. Then behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. He said to me, O Daniel, man of high esteem, understand the words that I am about to tell you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. Then he said to me, do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to your words. But that's going to be a different story here in a second. Let me stop there. This is the second time that an angel has been commanded by God to come to earth in a vision and explain something to Daniel. Where was the other time? I think it was 9, right? It was the big one in 9. This is the second time that an angel has been, he said, God told me to, I've been decreed to come. In both cases, why did the angel come? Why? I'm like a child now. Why? Why? Why did God tell him to? As a response to Daniel's prayers. I just think that's worth thinking about. Here's Daniel. How many things do we just not know, you know, today? I mean, it's not like we've got some vision we can't explain, but there's a lot of things I can't explain. There are a lot of timing things, a lot of providential things, a lot of God allowing things, a lot of things going on in me, and I can't get a grip on all these things. And maybe, without going too far with this text, maybe God's in heaven thinking, I want to show you. I want to make it clear to you. He may even do some angelic work. More on that in a second. I'm blown away by this chapter and its references to angels. And he's just holding it, but he will not send it. Why not? He's waiting on me. He's waiting on me to humbly, not for 30 seconds, it may be for 3 weeks, just keep pouring out my heart, asking for strength, asking for clarity, asking for guidance as a response to Daniel. In fact, there are some really great things said about Daniel in verses 12, 11, 12, and 13. In addition to the fact that Daniel is praying with this great humility, what are a couple of other things? And I think this is actually asked of you at the bottom of your page. What are a couple of other things about Daniel that almost trigger God's assistance? Tell me more about him. Not based on the past, but based on this chapter. Okay, greatly loved. Yeah. He wanted to understand. Look at verse 12 again. From the first day that you set your heart on understanding this, he wanted to know. I think that's something Christians need to think about. How many of us kind of pray, you know, God, you know, what are you doing? And what does this mean? What do I do? But we really don't want to set our heart to knowing. And God's holding it back saying, you're not ready. When you really want to know, when this is all you can think about is what I'm doing in your life or what's happening around you or what matters most, then I will send it. One of the things you see is he set his heart. He wanted to know. Knock, and God answers the door. I think a lot of us stand at the door just waiting on God to answer. You ever do that at somebody's house? You don't want to bother them and knock, so you just sort of stand there like they're supposed to know you're there. You get really hungry doing that. You got to reach up and say, I want to come inside. And they open the door. Really interesting. What are a couple of other things about Daniel in these short sections here? Yes, sir? Yeah. Humbling yourself or humbling yourself before your God. He did that as well. Interesting. He's a man of high esteem, verse 11. He's always kind of been that way, I think. From the very beginning, he was a man he's a teenager. All the way now, he's 90. From a man, you are a man of high esteem. Understand the words that I'm going to tell you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. He goes on to say, you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God. Your words were heard. I think there's just something about who he is to others and how he is to God. Man of high esteem who lowers himself before God. Yes.
So my version is verse 11, man greatly beloved, and that can be from his people, but it also can be
Yeah, man of, is that what you have in verse 11? Man greatly loved? Very nice. Beloved, very nice. All right. Reputation, yes.
The lesson here for us is, if we want our words to be heard when we pray to God, then we need to set our heart to understand and we need to humble ourselves.
Yeah, that's it. Set your heart.
The converse is going to be true. If we don't do those things, our word won't be true.
Yeah, if we don't do those things, our words won't be heard. I guess I get enamored by this idea of God. This is the way I've always seen it, right, wrong, or indifferent. Of God holding this bucket filled with blessings and understanding and guidance, and it's got my name on it. I mean, with a K, he spelled it right. It's right there. And he just wants more. He's such a loving God. He just wants to pour it out all over me and just absolutely cover me. But he can't because of me. Because I'm not seeking and humbling myself and begging and yearning and positioning. And I just don't want life to be like that. You know, I want everything in the bucket to come on down. Daniel's attitude triggered God's interaction. I think that's a key thing to think about. Yes.
And I think in connection with that, we have to know where our words need to come from. Daniel knew where his words need to come. In his prayer, he even says in chapter 9, verse 13, as it is written in the law of Moses, and all this disaster has come upon us, yet we have not made our prayer before the Lord our God that we might turn from our iniquities and understand your truth. He understood that for all of this to change, I need to make supplication to God.
Very good. Triggered it. Hey, our great final comment. Our time is up for today. We will get to start talking about angels on Wednesday night and then get into the pretty tough interpretation. All I want you to do is figure out Hebrews 1:14 by Wednesday night. That's all you need to do this week. Figure out Hebrews 1:14. All right.